Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lauffel, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther. And today we have, as I say, every single episode, a great guest. I'm talking about Curtis McGiffin, who is a friend, a co-author, and one of the great thinkers on nuclear issues. So, Curtis, welcome to NucleCast. It's good to have you.
Thanks, Adam. Glad to be here yet again.
So you wrote an interesting article for the National Institute for Public Policy here recently, and it was an article that the listeners can find online. If you go to NIP and you go to their information series, they'll find this. The article's titled DIMET, Shaping the Age of Techno-Strategic Power. And, you make an argument for changing the dime to the dimet. And so I thought we'd have a discussion about the argument you make and why you think we should change the dime. So with that, Curtis, can you maybe give us a summary of the argument that you make?
Well, Adam, again, thanks so much for allowing me on NucleCast. I really appreciate the opportunity. This article and the subject matter and the DIMET has been something that has been cooking in my brain for a couple of years. As you read my bio, I also teach for the School of Defense and Strategic Studies with Missouri State University, and one of the courses I teach is Grand Strategy. And we talk about national instruments of power all the time as part of grand strategy and the achieving of national power and the wielding of national power. And it has always bothered me that while I am a big fan of the DIME, which is an acronym for diplomatic, information, military, and economic power, all of those things are forms of power. I've always felt like there was something missing, and I'm observing the world and strategy writ large, and technology seems to have taken a life unto its own. And what I'm trying to do with this piece here that was published on September 22nd of 2025. It's issue number 637. If you go to the information series at the National Institute for Public Policy, so it's easy to find. It's really just designed to sort of make the argument that it's time to think about technology, specifically high tech, as a power onto its own, more than just an enabler of the dime. Many of our listeners will say, well, you know, there's technology with the military and there's technology, in diplomacy and how we do information through the internet and social media and these sorts of things. Of course, the economy is powered, through technology and all of those things. And that is all true. And it doesn't take away or change that fact. But what I'm saying in this article is that technology, while it enables the other four instruments of power in the dime, that nations are now measured and assessed by other nations as to how technologically advanced they are. So when you start to use that prism of technology, you begin to separate in the minds of the strategists and the policymakers, which nations might be becoming more powerful than others, or how they might influence certain sectors of the economy, of the global economy, and certainly of military power. And because this is NucleCast, it really goes down to the fact of how is technology affecting defense and deterrence writ large. And we look at today, even, Adam, we're looking at Golden Dome. That technology is now advanced enough that the U.S. is considering building Golden Dome, and what that will do on the other side with regard to nuclear technology as far as weapons go. And we see Russia testing nuclear-powered nuclear cruise missiles. And so we see that technology is really advanced power, military power, sure. But it has transcended that. It has gone from, to say, evolutionary to revolutionary.
Well, let me ask you, you know, because this sort of, as I hear you explaining your proposition, it makes me think a lot about the debate that we had about cyber as a domain. And, you know, I think I kind of initially and still wonder whether cyber is actually a domain, because cyber crosses, you know, the air, sea, space, domain. So therefore, you know, as I think about things, they all have to be mutually exclusive, right? So if cyber crosses the other domains, then it can't be a domain in and of itself. And so I kind of wonder, can technology be a component in and of itself? Is it mutually exclusive from the others? Or as you kind of make this point in your, you know, in your article early on, you say, well, it was, you know, it was seen as a support or an enabler. And then you argue, well, it's more than that. It deserves its own. But my question is it, you know, it's important clearly. And those countries that have the best technology have a tendency to win, right? If you can go back to the Civil War, and the North won because it had the ability to bring technology to bear in a way that the Confederacy couldn't. And you look at World War I and the importance technology had, but it clearly matters, but is it an end in of itself, or is it one of those things that really supports, you know, the other domains or the dime, or, you know, help me understand just exactly why it's set apart.
Yeah, so I'm one that does subscribe to the idea that cyber is its own domain. It's a man-made domain, excuse me, which is why it's different than the other domains. But when you think about how we think of it, air, land, and sea, but space transcends all of those. I mean, you can't fly an airplane or deliver an artillery piece or sail a ship without some sort of space support, whether it be for navigation or communication or some sort of targeting assistance and these sorts of things. So space is also transcending all of those. But there is also, so that's the enabler, but there is also weapons in space. There's conflict going on in space, for example. And then there are counter systems to those things specifically for the space domain. And using the Civil War is a great example, but there was no space domain. And so technology was different. So when we think about technology in my argument, we're talking about high tech. And so when we look at the battlefield today, for example, at least from the defense or military point of view, what I'm talking about is technology as an enabler might allow us or allow the adversaries or the opponents on the battlefield to see the battlefield better, to navigate better, again, to fire more accurate weapons, kinetic weapons, be able to encrypt your radios so that the adversary doesn't know what you're doing. Those sorts of things are enablers. But it's when technology becomes the weapon itself, whether it be directed energy beams, unmanned aerial vehicles, drones, EMP weapons, these sorts of things. This is what we're talking about in this high-tech revolution, that it is changing the battlefield. The Ukraine example is huge with regard to drone warfare. It has literally changed the way future wars will be fought. And now is there is now a race for better AI, a race for better drone and autonomous weapon systems, and the policy and strategy is trying to catch up. And so what I'm arguing is that the states that are pursuing those areas more fervently than others are essentially the technological leaders of the world. And they are going to be viewed differently and their power is going to be assessed differently than states that are merely using technology as an enabler. And that's sort of the difference there. Hopefully that gets to your point.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's certainly, you know, as I'm listening to you again, I kind of think is, you know, the dime is something where we oftentimes use it to say, hey, are you considering these things? Are you considering the diplomatic, the economic, the military, the information? So maybe in that sense, then adding the T, are you considering, you know, how technology can impact, you know, your ability to achieve your national objectives? In that sense, I think it can make sense. So on that, I'll agree with you. Now, there was another thing, and I know we didn't originally set our discussion up to cover this, but in the pre-show discussion, you mentioned that there is a NIDS version, and the National Institute for Deterrent Studies is producing its own version of a nuclear posture review. And that is coming out soon, and perhaps by the time this podcast releases, that will have, you know, that will have been published and will be out and available on the web. So I thought, man, it would be a terrible waste of an opportunity if we didn't incorporate that publication into this podcast as well. So if you don't mind, I'm going to audible, and I'm going to ask you to also tell us a little bit about that publication, and you know, what's it called? Where is it going to be available? And you know, sort of what's the fundamental argument that you make in your version of the nuclear posture review?
Well, sure, Adam. So in the National Institute for Public Policy, you know, they're concerned about this technological aspects and sort of the greater strategy. At the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, we're trying to focus more on the strategy of deterrence and how we might think about doing it differently. And there have been some thought leaders in this space who have sort of espoused the idea that the Trump administration does not need another nuclear posture review, that it takes too long to create these things. It consumes a lot of political time and capital, and we already know what we need to do, and we need to, you know, we could look at President Trump's previous nuclear posture review from 2018, or we can sort of embrace the Strategic Posture Commission report to Congress that came out in late 2023. And that Posture Commission is an influencer in the report that we did. But I'll say this. So you know, we sort of took the position of, yeah, we really think that the administration not only should, but must have an NPR. These become source documents, resource guidance, and policy instruments, methods of strategic diplomacy and other means in which to communicate to ourselves and to the world, both friends and foes alike, what the Trump administration intends for our nuclear posture. I think neglecting that is not the right thing to do with perhaps the most powerful weapons on the planet, as in a time where nuclear challenges we've not seen this level of nuclear challenge, so to speak, since the end of the Cold War. And so even though there are fewer numbers in warheads and systems, technology has played a role in making what little there is more accurate, more lethal, delivered differently and through different vectors, which compresses time. Adam, you and I wrote an article in 2019 that talked about attack time compression and what technology was doing to that, to create complexity and fear with regard to attacks on the homeland. And so what we tried to look at in this NPR is to provide some guidance of where we think as a deterrence think tank, if you will, where we should be leading to, and that we, in our perception, we're not where we need to be today. And there's a lot of work to be done, and there's also a lot of work that can be done to change the circumstances that I feel and others that the nation is getting pressured with regard to nuclear weapons, nuclear coercion, and the threat of great power conventional war, whether it be in the Indo-Pacific or in Europe. And these are real challenges, and the reality is we must engage in a more proactive, more maximum means in order to ensure deterrence is ready to, or I should say, is going to be successful moving forward. When we think about it, we spend a fair amount of money on our nuclear arsenal, but it's only about a tenth over the next 10 years. It's about a 10-to-1 ratio of what we spend on nukes and what we will spend on nukes versus what we'll spend on conventional warfighting capability. And I think we're arguing that ratio is probably should be a little more balanced in order to ensure that we fight fewer wars. And that should be the ultimate goal. There's some estimates out there that if China were to forcibly reunify Taiwan, that would cost the global economy $10 trillion in the first year. That's a pretty significant amount of money. And when you think about, we're not even going to spend $1 trillion over 10 years for arguably the most advanced nuclear arsenal in the world in order to keep peace. That's a pretty fair amount of insurance that we would get for, pennies on the dollar. And I think that is worth arguing for. And that's what we have attempted to do here with our nuclear posture review proposal.
So are there some specific, recommendations that you have in terms of, you want more of one system or a new capabilities or different postures? Is there something, very specific that you would offer the listeners that you recommend?
Yeah. So in our piece, which is called in our posture review proposal, the title is Peace Through Strength, Peace, P-E-A-C-E versus Peace. Peace Through Strength, Renewing America's Nuclear Deterrent, a proposed nuclear posture review for 2026. Again, our goal is to sort of get in the arena of ideas and maybe pull the Department of War over to our side of the argument. And so when we sort of look at the world in sort of two phases, what should be fixed now, like in the next 2 years? Everybody says 2027 is the magical year that we need to be watching out for with regard to Indo-Pacific. So what can we do in the next 2 years to bolster deterrence? And then what do we need to do looking beyond? Because regardless of what these great powers do that are competing with us in the next 2 to 3 years, they're not going to relent in the next 10. And so we've got to be looking forward as to what we need to do. So we make some arguments. Many are, we sort of have seen out there in the world before, the arguments of, we should do some uploading of our hedge. We need to consider changing some of our force posture to make it more survivable signaling with how we change that posture. Sort of multiplying, with what we already have, right? There's a call for that, right? It's just a change of mindsets, relying on technologies we have today with regard to surveillance and tactical warning and these sorts of things. And then there's sort of a look moving forward. You know, what can technology do for us looking forward? And while we acknowledge, you know, the possibility of Golden Dome, we really don't get into that in a nuclear posture review. But what we do try to look at is how do we diversify our arsenal? How do we make it more resilient and more bang for the buck, more lethal? Again, using the terminology of our Secretary of War, how do we do deterrence better? And I think it's making it more lethal, which is what he believes. And I think it's about putting a little bit more fear on the shoulders of our adversaries so that they'll stand up, think twice, and maybe slow down in some of the aggressive and coercive movements that they do. This might include adding a mobile leg to our ICBM capability. It might include purchasing more numbers of Sentinel, of B-21, and so forth. It looks at maybe adding more cruise missile vectors, whether it is making LRSO, having a ground version, more sea-launched capabilities. One of the things we advocate that's a little bit different than the rest of the than I've seen out there in the rest of the world is taking those guided ballistic missile submarines and loading them with nuclear-armed, you know, cruise missiles rather than, you know, just tactically conventionally armed Tomahawks. And you increase the at-sea deterrent by about 28%. Without adding a new submarine and the costs that go along with that using what we have today. I understand there's a goal to try to retire some of these Ohio-class boats, and that may not be possible in the world we have today. So our posture review argues that you know, the services need to figure out, you know, how we would do this. And as usual, Adam, we will get the same pushback, right? It will be, it's too extreme or it's too expensive. And what it really comes down to, Adam, is prioritization, right? What's the priority? And that's why, you know, what I think the underlying tone of this posture review proposal is that we need to think more about arming for deterrence and less about arming for war. And I think if we can, those are not necessarily the same. And so we need to consider those sorts of things. And technology, to say, is really helping to expand the possibility of these things. What I find holds us back isn't the technology. It isn't the money. It's the mindsets.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's a good point. And there's also, because we're stuck, you mentioned mindset, and we're kind of stuck in this mindset that, well, what we're going to do is we're going to build the new iteration of the things we've always had. And mm-hmm. we really haven't, you know, we've never sort of done like a zero-based study of, hey, what would we actually want to build if we were to build our nuclear arsenal from scratch? And what would it look like? Because right. I have a feeling it might look a lot different than it does today. But, you know, that's,
well, you
that's
know,
sort of...
You and I wrote a strategy last summer called Dynamic Parity. And one of the things that we argued about the nuclear strategy of dynamic parity is that we should look a little bit more alike our adversaries. This is where the mobile systems, for example, come into play. There are American mindsets that say, hey, if we were to have road mobiles, it would be destabilizing. And my argument, my counter argument to that is it wouldn't be, because they already have them. They don't think it's destabilizing. They don't think it's destabilizing that they have them and we don't. And for some reason, we don't think it's destabilizing that they have them and we don't. I think it's terribly destabilizing.
I think
that they have something that we don't have.
Well, I think your main problem is that you fundamentally don't understand the definition of destabilizing. Let me define that for
yes.
you. Destabilizing is anything that the Americans do to improve their circumstances that is inherently destabilizing. That's the definition. It's right. just anything we do to be better. it's fundamentally destabilizing by definition.
Exactly. Exactly. So, it is, for some reason that, as a status quo power, there's this mindset that's pushed forward here that whatever we do to change the status quo is in a sense destabilizing, but all of the challenging powers out there are seeking to upset that same status quo. Yet we don't seem to address that as destabilizing as it really is.
You make a good point. I mean, Think about it, what you just said. Russia and China fundamentally want to topple the status quo as it currently exists. Yet somehow activities to do that very thing are not destabilizing. But our efforts to maintain the status quo, those are destabilizing. And
especially when it means that we... That's right. And especially when it means that we might have to do a little bit more in order to ensure that status quo remains. Again, a world that is led by Western democracies writ large and the United States specifically, I think is probably a more pleasant and fair world than one led by autocracies who seek regional hegemony for sure and global hegemony. Perhaps. And I'm not sure, I'm not sure we want to live under the guidance of those sorts of states. And so if, we only have one chance to prevent that from happening, right? Because once it happens, right, it happens. So this is why we argue that we've got to, essentially, get stronger, and assert that kind of power. And technology, I think, is the way to do that. There's no question, Adam, that the United States is viewed as a technological state, right? As a leading technological country in the world, right? We can argue, I would say China as well. And there are many others that, we can sort of debate on the periphery. Not to insult countries, but there are certain countries that are more active in this or not. And technology is really becoming the new measure of power when you think about how their economies move forward and how the corporations of technology within those states are huge. In regard, we have in America, and I'm not going to name the companies, you could read it in the article, but in America, we have certain high-tech corporations whose value, the company value, is larger than the stock markets, the combined stock markets of certain countries. And this is one high-tech, top 10 industry, S&P 500 type company. Yeah. So, to understand just how powerful these countries are, it's probably not Walmart, right? So it's a tech company. They're the ones that are changing the world. They're the ones that are matching and growing the wealth. And so, along with that is international prestige, is international confidence, and the innovation that grows with it. If you're a country that's birthing new capabilities, innovative new ways of doing things, and tools of which to do them with, you're naturally going to be a leading power. And that's sort of the argument with my Shaping the Age of Techno-Strategic Power. And when you combine that with where we think that the NPR needs to be in the future, where America's nuclear deterrent needs to be in the future, it isn't about regression. High-tech states don't regress. They advance. They move forward. And they take on the threats that are before them. And I think that's what we're advocating to do, to what I'm advocating in this piece, article, and what I think our offering for the arena of ideas when it comes to America's nuclear deterrent moving forward. There's much work to be done, Adam, and you and I have lamented a number of times. We are 15 years into a 30-year modernization program, and we are still waiting for some operational iron on the ramps and iron in the silos. And it may well be that we need to wait on new silos. And so there are other ways to do this, and we have to change our mindset. Mobility is one of them. And we have a vast country in which to hide mobile systems. We don't have to do it on the American highways or railways. And so we just have to be willing to change our mindset. I guess I'm arguing here, Adam, that it's okay to embrace different methods to ensure your security and your sovereignty. And we should be doing that.
Join the ANWA Deterrent Center and NucleCast at the annual Nuclear Deterrence Summit, January 26th through 28th at the Crystal Marriott in Arlington, Virginia. This premier event brings together decision makers from government, national laboratories, and industry for strategic updates, high-value networking, and practical conversations that drive partnerships and business. Sign up through the link on our website to receive a 15% discount at anwadeter.org. We hope to see you there.
Now, unfortunately, we are actually out of time, but I don't want to end the show without rubbing my magic lamp and giving Bob the opportunity to grant your three wishes.
Bob the Genie.
So very quickly, can you tell us, Curtis McGiffin, what is your first wish?
Okay. Well, I guess I would say my first wish is that I would really like to see whatever the Department of War and the administration decides to do. My first wish is that we need to change the mindset and of our military and consider the idea that we need to arm for deterrence rather than defense or rather than war. And so I think what happens is that we have we get folks out there that find that we want the next great weapon system and in which to utilize and change the world, so to speak. And if you're going to run an America First policy or doctrine, and then I think it starts with your nuclear deterrence. It doesn't end with your nuclear deterrence. I'd like to see that mindset change. That would be my first.
Okay, that's a good one. How about wish number two?
So I think wish number two is, I think there's little doubt that the country is going to move forward with Golden Dome. And I think there are some great possibilities with Golden Dome. My wish, though, is that we do not forget the value of the offensive threat. There is no way that we can ensure our country's security and sovereignty through defense only, right? If we're playing football in the NFL, no team wins championships by only leaving their defense on the field and never running an offense to score. And so while my previous wish was we can't, we need to not build so much of this offensive warfighting capability, we also can't forget it either. And especially when it comes to the nuclear arsenal, I think I fear that if the Golden Dome works as intended and it's affordable, that there might be a desire to argue that we do not need nuclear weapons anymore, that our Golden Dome will protect us. And I just don't think that is the case. I think the 12-day war proved that between Israel and Iran, that you can only outlast so many shots. And then you have to go and shoot the shooters. And that's what really came down to, is the Israelis had to go and shoot the shooters. And so we always must have an offensive threat. The threat of punishment is not erased by a more secure defense.
Yeah, good point. Now you're down to your final wish. So what is that last one?
So I wish I, you know, I should have prepared for this, Adam. I wish I had thought through this a little bit.
Well, that's part of the joy of Bob is that
I know.
By virtue of putting you on the spot, you're more honest and
I know, but I knew unscripted. Bob was going to come up. And so I should have thought about this a little bit harder. I think my third wish is we need to have bipartisan consistency. Whether we're going to build, you know, an aggressive military, you know, bent on interventionism, or one that is more sovereign designed, America first, I think built around a strong nuclear deterrent. We've got to exude greater credibility. And obviously it starts with some of our bipartisan politics. But we've got to be able to show our allies and our adversaries that we mean business. And I think to do that, it starts with reasonable and more rapid acquisition and commitment in that regard. We spend money on the things we care about. Our allies watch what we spend money on, and when they perceive that we are not going to spend money on a nuclear deterrent, why is it that we would be shocked that they would say, well, I'm not sure I believe in the credibility of your nuclear deterrent if you're not going to spend money on it, if you're not going to advance, if you're not going to match the threat that's out there? How can you tell me there's enough for me if there's not even enough for you as I perceive it? And so, and that's an important word to inject in here, the power of perception. And so I think in my final is that we really need to change the mindset, gain credibility, and think in the long term of what needs to be done, right, wrong, or indifferent. This constant stopping and starting and moving left and moving right, both politically and apolitically, with regard to the nuclear deterrent, I think is severely detrimental to the deterrent itself. If we are not committed to getting to a point where it needs to be that addresses real threats, then it'll always be a strategic ambiguity as to whether or not we'll actually, you know, be able to carry through it with credibility and capability. And we cannot continue to just convince ourselves that it'll work and that we're the best. We've got to show it. And we do that through what we fund, how we buy it, what our politicians say about it. And that way our allies and adversaries alike will perceive that strength that we need to ensure yet not today.
Yeah. Well, with that, we'll make that the last word, yet not today. That's always the goal of deterrence. So, you know, thinking about how do we make that concept remain for the future, hopefully for the long term. That seems to be one of the things we think most about. And I'm sure it's one of the things our listeners think about every day as well. So, Curtis McGiffin, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
No, thanks for having me, Adam. I really appreciate it.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you next time. Always great to talk with Curtis. You know, he's a friend, but he's also one of the guys who, you know, he comes up with a lot of great ideas. He's always trying to be creative and think of, you know, new topics, new concepts, and I really appreciate that. About him, and you know, it always leads to interesting conversation. So hopefully you enjoyed the conversation. I did as well. And read those documents, because I'm sure they're excellent.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Frunkel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.